Hello, thank you so much. I work on a horse-powered farm north of here, about 90 minutes, and you mentioned the different research that's so important for lower emissions technologies on farms, and I'd love to hear more about the work that's happening in the countries you've been working with or visions that you see for ways that farming can be sustained and also protecting the soil and reducing our emissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Should I take the next one? Or
Go ahead. We're just going to take a couple more minutes, so if there are more questions, let's get them all now, and then Dr. Sabanda can answer.
Yeah, I also just want to say thank you so much for coming to speak here. You're incredibly inspiring and just radiant. I kind of have thoughts and I guess a question at the end, but I've seen a lot of statistics going around that say that, you know, we do indeed have the capabilities to feed the whole world over, possibly even multiple times. But I think, you know, one of the greatest barriers to us being able to do that is the fact that, the means of production to create this food is not used for all of societies everywhere, for the whole of the world. And rather, the means of production are used to create profit for a few. And so I was wondering what your opinions are on the capitalist system and how it affects food insecurity. And do you think that we should perhaps move towards a socialist society where the masses control the means of production for the betterment of all rather than the profits of a few? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think I have a parallel question to that, which is you in your think tank, you come up with, it sounds like, you know, really appropriate policies. My question is, to what extent do the governments in Africa, in the countries where you're working, to what extent do they get in the way? To what extent do they listen to you? Because, you know, there are a number of governments, I won't mention any in particular, where the governors are much more interested in enriching themselves and their families than in feeding hungry people.
I work with a population that doesn't have many access to resources here in Maine. Mm-hmm. And they're eating a lot of foods that are not real foods. Mm-hmm. They're not micronutrient rich. They may have the food, but they're also very addicted to the highly processed sugars and the carbohydrates. How do we begin to educate and ask the tough questions to get not just food to these people, but food that is nourishing and not addictive? How do we approach that conversation without being offensive, patronizing?
Thank you. I will take those. Okay, someone's already, that makes it five. Please go ahead.
It was an honor to have dinner with you. Thank you for coming. I'm originally from Zambia, which is next to Zimbabwe. I just wanted you to, is there any social welfare right now in Africa, or is your organization addressing that now?
Thank you. It's all right. Let me honor the questions and follow the order in which I was hoping to combine them. Is there social welfare? It's linked to the profit and not-for-profit balance. Every African government I know of has a ministry of social welfare. But the biggest actors in most of our constituencies have been the non-governmental organizations that have become the implementers of the policies that the governments have in place. Now, traditionally, you had the communal system where the village chief was the custodian of those policies. And where I come from in Zimbabwe, there was always a dedicated field that was the chief's field. He would have his own family plot, but in addition to that, there would be one where the community went in to work as a collective, as a cooperative, to make sure the harvest is put in a special granary that was for welfare cases. That is no longer happening for many reasons. The able-bodied people have moved away. There is a shortage of labor, believe it or not, in our family farms. People are struggling to get labor for weeding, for cultivating. Farming has become difficult. And the able-bodied who used to be doing the manual work have either gone to the mines, gone to the city, and when they are there, they are not healthy. And partly that's a reflection of the lack of investment in the public health system. Now, who fills that gap? It's the international NGOs. It's the government that has to create a policy environment that makes sure what we get as help is appropriate and brings dignity to the people. And that's where our network comes in. We don't implement policy. We are the watchdog that sort of blows the whistle to say, why is every household getting seed when not all of them are farmers? Why can't you look and match the intervention to the need? Why are people getting soy when they don't like it and they don't eat it, but just because you tick the box and say you've given it? Why are we buying food elsewhere, yet within the country you could purchase food that could help a neighboring community? Surely the mathematics there needs to be revisited. So we are just a voice that collects the evidence and brings it to dialogue. If we get answers, we take them to those who are affected by the problem so that the policies are informed by practice. Next one, what do you do when you've got limited resources? Where does the food come from? What do you do to make sure that there's nutrition security? That was the question. I think the fundamentals are, what does agriculture do for nutrition? For a long time, I was one of the proponents of the Green Revolution, but now I advocate for a rainbow revolution. I now know that that milk was good for me, those eggs were good for me, that meat was good for me, and that the diversity, the sweet potatoes, the cowpeas, the beans, and the vegetables and the fruits that I enjoyed were good for me, but they are no longer affordable. So my main message to policymakers is, can we flood the market with nutrient-dense food? And I'll tell you how to do that. Make sure that the seed that the farmers use, make sure the soil that the farmers are growing crops on have enough nutrients that can then be taken up by these crops, so that we don't generate crops or empty calories for feeding people. We want nutrient-dense commodities. Let's also look at the price of these nutrient-dense commodities. That's your role as a consumer. Laws of demand and supply tell me that if we increase the demand, the supply will also increase. But currently, some of these nutrient-dense foods are for the elite. That's why they're expensive. But surely we can bring the price down by stimulating the laws of supply and demand. All that is a policy game that our policymakers need to play. And one of the ways they can help us is when there are big agriculture programs, particularly for us in Africa, we are saying, can you go back to that investor if you've taken a loan from the World Bank? If it's about increasing corn yields, go back and tell the investor that we now know of protein maize, a special seed that has been bred to double the protein content of the corn. So why are we opting for the ordinary seed which has low protein? Go back to the investor and tell them there is now zinc fertilizer which carries zinc which can be taken up by the plant and it ends up in the commodity, and that's a natural way of fortifying our crops. Also tell the investor that there are a lot of leakages in the way we do our agriculture, right from the cropping, the storage, up to 40% of the losses in African agriculture are in the production cycle. In Africa, we are wasting. There are leakages of nutrients and leakages of yield. Surely we can plug that. But the scariest statistic I've heard is on aflatoxin, whereby we are producing contaminated groundnuts, contaminated maize, and part of that aflatoxin contamination has been attributed to causing cancer. The decoupling of health, agriculture, and nutrition has landed us where we are now, and we need to plug those holes and create a community where medical practitioners speak to nutritionists and speak to farmers, so that what we produce is nutrient dense, and we should be thriving for a healthy community, not just more money in the pocket. So there are many ways that we can make sure we design our agriculture programs so that they don't just do for yield, they do for income, they do for nutrition. But the biggest challenge is education, not the college education my father Majele wanted, but behavior change. We all at times know what to do, we all know what to eat, but changing behavior is tough. So we have a job there. It's not just educating the mothers, it's the whole family. We can do something. And there's a close link to what you ate in your mother's tummy and the non-communicable diseases that we're facing. Hypertension, diabetes, all that can be linked. And sadly, it's the stunted children who are showing high propensity for diabetes, for obesity, and hypertension. So surely we can reduce our health costs by investing in agriculture and doing agriculture that's for nutrition. To what extent do governments listen? Well, the beauty at FANPAN is we have them in the puzzle, we have them in the table, and we hold them accountable. Whether you decide to close your eyes and say, well, you were there. And advocacy is about bringing evidence, giving you the evidence, giving you a place on the table to tell us why you've chosen to do A instead of B. And when you've taken your B stance, we don't make you an enemy. We keep you as a friend. And one thing I know is there's nothing as good as keeping your enemy guessing that they are a friend. You can always go around the corner and say, what's this all about? Then there was the low emissions. One of the things we are pushing for is conservation agriculture. We have been taught as part of the Green Revolution, deep plow, but one thing that we know now from science is that as you deep plow, you are emitting carbon which was kept tight in the soil, and that is contributing to greenhouse gases. So where you can get the implements for precision farming, minimum disturbance of the soil will conserve. Other thing is cover. We have mixed crop livestock systems whereby people would rather harvest, cut, and carry the residues so that they feed their livestock. So we're trying to promote a balance, bring the livestock to the field so that they deposit the cow dung, the urine, but more important, the grain is harvested by the animals in situ and providing cover that will minimize the emissions that can come in. Then also basic rotation. These are things that as we push the Green Revolution, as my cousin, nephew, Moses was planting the land, he just wanted profits. But now we see that there's damage, but he can only adopt conservation agriculture if we finance him with new tools for precision agriculture, if we equip him with the knowledge, and also if we provide the livestock that he has sold off to finance his health bill. So it's complex, but it can be done. How do we abandon the capitalist system and go back to... I go back to St. Mary's. I think there was a gentleman there when we were at the nutrition center with the hunger fighters. He said, you know what? We need a cooperative system. And at that time, I can see nods. I think the sad thing we have in Africa is that cooperatives came at a time of socialism. I don't want to name the country R, but it was associated with all the things that were happening there, and people said, no, one man for themselves. But where we find where there were cooperatives for farming that were linking the whole value chain from inputs to the sale of commodities, they worked. But where it was introduced in the whole smallholder farming sector, it was work as a group, go and plant in everybody's field, share everything you got, and there was no equity. So I think a well-crafted system that is informed bottom-up and is well understood by the actors and has been modeled right. The biggest challenge we have in Africa is everyone comes there with prescriptions. And one thing we've been teaching our constituents is, ask where has it been done before? I'm happy to have been learning here because I'll say, I'll take you to the people who are doing this. I'll take you to the Good Shepherd Bank and you'll see them. I'll take you to the St. Mary's community. I'll take you to the rooftop gardens. I'll take you to Bete and Mufalo. They will tell you what to do. And I think that's what we need, sharing of best practices, because we have the same problems. And surely the solutions you have can take us halfway. All we need to do is to adapt them to our local conditions. And that's how learning goes. And that's what I've enjoyed about being here.
I can't tell you how many girls approached me afterwards at Deering, at Waynefleet, at USM, at Tree Street, and said, I want to be her when I grow up. Let me close by bringing it back to Maine. The statistic that the dean mentioned, 1 in 4 children in Maine is food insecure, that took my breath away when I first heard it. Because that means for anyone who has school-age children, when your child brings home the picture, the class picture, 25% of the kids in that picture don't know where they're going to get their next meal. I mean, that's really shocking. According to a recent USDA report, 208,000 Mainers currently experience food insecurity, and that number is growing. A disproportionate number of those Mainers are women. As the dean said, we now have the third highest rate of very low food security. Mississippi is ahead of us. We don't think of ourselves that way. And as Dee told us, and as Dr. Sibanda told us, there's one thing that all these Mainers who are food insecure have in common: they're all living in poverty. The number of children in Maine living in extreme poverty has grown 50% since 2011. All week long, we've been hearing about food insecurity experts, from food insecurity experts who've been describing the challenges that they face here in Maine. And I've been struck by the fact that those are the very same challenges that Dr. Sibanda is describing in Africa. It's the same. The problem is the same. We don't think of ourselves that way. Dr. Sibanda talks about hidden hunger, that is not a lack of food, but a lack of nutritious food, and stunting, that is one of its most devastating effects, impaired cognitive development in children. Well, hunger in Maine is hidden also. Children are malnourished here also. Another fact that shocked me is to learn from the USDA and Health and Human Services data that for my son's generation, the rate of stunting among children in the United States was 13%. It's like Africa. We need to apply some of what we've learned from Dr. Sibanda this week. her strategies for engaging policymakers, for developing sustainable policies, for holding leaders accountable, and for lifting people out of poverty. She's described this mapping that they promote in their organization as good policy, which results in getting the right responses to people that will not only feed them today, but help them lift themselves. So for the fifth year in a row, Justice for Women has brought an extraordinary leader from the developing world to Maine. We've learned so much from these women, and we've had an overwhelming positive response in smaller meetings, as well as to this lecture when it happens every March. We cut off registration for this lecture at 720 people, afraid we wouldn't be able to accommodate everybody. To me, Justice for Women is a public-private partnership in the very best sense of the word. It's what can happen when the private sector supports our public educational institutions, programs like this. But I have to say it, Dean Conway needs our help to make this program sustainable and an annual event. We've grown the Justice for Women Endowment from zero to approximately $270,000. We need those of you who can to reach deep into your pockets, but also know that no contribution is too small. We need to get to $475,000, and we need your help. For anyone who happens to have a checkbook with you tonight, I will ask for your checkbooks. Feel free to stop by the Justice for Women table, make a contribution, pick up your Justice for Women bag at the same time. The bags that you see out there were made by the women who escaped prostitution and who now are in the program that's led by last year's Justice for Women speaker. So those women made those bags for us. So please, get one. 100% of the proceeds, by the way, go into the endowment. There are also several other tables out there that feature just a few of the very many good programs that are going on here in Maine. So stop by on your way out, take a look. I urge you to learn about them, sign up to volunteer, and contact your legislator and ask, what are you doing for food insecurity in Maine? So, I want to thank all of you, and stay tuned for next year.
Love to manhandle people. Thank you for that impassioned plea for support. I promised Kathy, or threatened her last year when I met her, that I was going to institute a Courage is Contagious Award. Kathy Lee, you are the inaugural recipient.
Thank you. Oh, that's so nice. I can't believe you did this. Thank you. Can I open it now?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.